We interrupt our program to bring you this important message.
Hi, I'm Chucky. Wanna play?
You know, it's Halloween. I guess everyone's entitled to one good scare.
Be afraid.
No. Be afraid. Be very afraid.
Ghouls and gore. And sometimes a little more. My Bloody Podcast.
Hello, welcome everybody to My Bloody Podcast. Oh my goodness, it's the new year, mid-January. I can't believe we're getting to Valentine's Day already. But this is episode 78. 78 times we've done this podcast. I'm surprised we've lasted this long with all the blood and guts we've had to walk through. But I'm Brian Kluger with Boomstick Comics and High Def Digest. And we have a special show today. We're going to be talking about Knives Out. I'm joined by my man of the hour, who I would want to commit a murder and get away with, Preston Barta. What's up, buddy?
Yeah, here I am with my cane like Michael as well.
Perfect, perfect. And then, of course, my other muse, knight in shining armor, Mark Chaffordini. What's up, man?
It's good to see you, hetero life mate.
Yeah, oh, it's good, HLM.
I'm your token Italian coming in every odd episode.
Yes, your Italian-ness just... Well, we're both Italian, so we've got the Italian stallion in us. I don't know.
That's why we like each other.
That's why we like each other.
We've got to the source.
Bill Conti style. But we have a very special, legendary guest today on the show. Nathan Johnson, film composer. His most recent work, the Oscar-nominated Knives Out, one of my favorite films of the year. We're going to be talking about the score, the film, and just talking to this man, Nathan Johnson. Nathan Johnson is coming to us all the way from the West Coast in L.A., I believe. Nathan, how you doing, buddy?
Good. Thanks for having me on the show.
Great to have you. Thanks for being on here. I'm just going to start out here with you. So, Nathan, where did it all begin for you? Where did it all begin music-wise for you?
Well, Ryan and I are cousins. We grew up together sort of ever since we were little kids making movies and making music on family vacations. So we kind of have been doing it our whole lives. And in high school, I was sort of in a bunch of garage bands, and that continued through college while Ryan was going to film school. And then about 6 years after he wrote this movie called Brick right out of film school. And about 6 years later, made it. And I was living in England at the time, and he asked if I would be up for doing the score. And I said yes and dove in, and we haven't looked back.
Sweet. No, that's great.
Speaking of Brick, I listened to the great podcast that you did with Mr. David Chin, Culturally Relevant. And you spoke about at length about the off-kilter kind of approach that you took to Brick, using wine glasses and doing chopsticks on radiators and old pianos and things of that nature. But I'm curious if now that you've done Knives Out, which has, you have a whole orchestra, you have more resources at your hands. If you had that with Brick, how different do you think that your approach to music would be now?
The sense that, we had a limited budget was actually really, really helpful in some senses. I love the idea of restrictions anyway, but I think with Brick, it was actually to realize like, okay, I here's the area that I've got to play around in, and that's what we'll limit it to.
Well, Nathan, going big picture here, when you dive into something, whether you have the script or not, whether you've seen any film or dailies, is it more important to you to get the emotion right, or is it more important to get the expectation of what type of music the genre film is?
Yeah, that's a great question. To be honest, I actually don't really spend much time thinking about the second part of that in terms of what expectation the music is for the genre. all I'm really trying to do is get inside the director's head and help them tell the story they're telling. And, you know, that at a bigger meta level, of course, each film kind of exists within the realm of genre. But for me, I'm very much focused on, you know, dialing in the emotion of what's happening. But really that all has to do with what the director wants to convey in a scene. You know, it's not me bringing my idea of what the emotion is to it. It's me paying really close attention to, you know, from the director's perspective, who is this scene focusing on? What perspective is it playing from? And then once I know that, that's when I feel like I can kind of let loose and go for it.
No, that's great.
I was just going to piggyback off of that, since the score of Knives Out has, like, I think even David Chin mentioned this too, that it has sort of like a sad feel to it. And going off of what Mark just said there, it's just recently that I'm beginning to notice, I saw the movie Jojo Rabbit and talked to somebody from that film, but the script, as Taika wrote it, it's a comedic kind of approach and how the characters portray it, but the way that the camera zooms in, it gives an emotional feel. I'm focusing on the sad part of the story, and it's all happening simultaneously, like this perfect marriage. And so I wonder what sort of discussions you had with Ryan, going from scene to scene, to know which sort of emotions you wanted to heighten, if Ryan was going to allow the script or the performances to elevate the comedy while you were going to focus on the situation at hand, which is you're dealing with death.
Yeah. I mean, Ryan, the great thing about working with him is he is very particular and he's such a great collaborator. You know, I think what makes a great collaborator is not someone who's just like, hey, do whatever you want. This is your show. What makes a great collaborator in terms of a director is someone who actually has a very specific idea about what they want, at least in setting up the parameters, but then is really excited to let you play inside of that playground and surprise them. And so that's really what the rhythm of working with Ryan is like. We're talking about broad, you know, sort of broad parameters at the beginning. You know, and before we even start shooting, he's kind of giving me references, or we're talking about, you know, other music that we like, and even just like random conceptual ideas. But then once we're at the point of going scene to scene, you know, and by this point, I've already had a lot of time interacting with him in terms of like giving him ideas for thematic ideas and for melodic motifs. So we've already honed in a lot, but then once we, you know, I think to answer your question, once we get to the scene by scene level, he knows exactly the story that he's telling, and every camera move that he's arranged with Steve, our cinematographer, the performances that he's collaborated on with the actors. I mean, he has painted this whole thing, and the music needs to play a very specific role in order for the film to work.
That's cool. I was curious if there's any research you do for any of your scores, like there are certain movies you watch or music you listen to, and specifically for Knives Out, for like the noir murder mystery, mixing the balance of comedy and drama into it, if there was any inspirations or any research you did for it.
Yeah, I mean, I think I don't know that I like would consider it so much research, but I guess maybe it is in a way. But yeah, not like specific films that I went and watched, but Ryan and I were talking about the way some of these old lush scores that we love from like the late 50s, early 60s worked. And, you know, Ryan was at first when he told me, I mean, he had the idea for this movie 10 years ago, although he didn't actually sit down to start writing it until like a year before they finished filming. So early on I knew about it, and I think at that point I was thinking sort of this like claustrophobic small kinetic approach to the score. But when we first started talking about the music, he was like, no, I think because basically the whole movie takes place in one location, I think we need to push against that and go really big. We need to kind of explode the score and do like a big lush orchestral score. And so we were talking about movies like Lawrence of Arabia, you know, a lot of Bernard Herrmann scores, these scores that are very, very big, but also very precise and focused. And, you know, that was one of the other things that Ryan kept saying, is he wanted the music to be sharp like a knife, like every other element, you know, and that's the way the screenplay is written. It's all precise. There's a bunch of people, but you can hear each of their distinct voices. So that really informed my whole approach to how we did an orchestral score, but still kept it really precise.
Sweet. I like it.
Well, I'm glad you brought up Bernard Herrmann, because one of the things I noticed in a track like Foul Play, Bernard liked to have some fun with the score. It wasn't just a straight up orchestral piece. And similar to what John Williams did with, I think it was the spider scene in Raiders of the Lost Ark, he did this sort of real fast plucking of the strings, and it almost, I think there's a part in Foul Play that had a element like that. At what point in your process do you go from straight musical score to these things that almost sound like sound design or effects?
Oh, yeah, that's such a great question. I mean, It's interesting, you know, because I feel like a lot of my approach to music involves the idea of like approaching it sound wise. I mean, it's weird. I love melody so much, but at the same time, I feel so excited about the idea that that music is not always just made with traditional instruments, but can be made and found in any sounds. You know, I remember when I was growing up seeing Stomp, which is, you know, these guys like making these rhythms out of trash cans and brooms and kind of really, really exciting uses of everyday objects. And that excitement of finding sounds and even finding melodic sounds inside of everyday objects just really, really excites me. So I think that is kind of been inherent in my approach to film scoring. Although, you know, with Looper, for instance, I went down to New Orleans and just spent like weeks gathering field recordings that we then turned into these playable sounds. So, you know, a lot of the Looper score is made up of treadmills that have been tuned and sped up and slowed down, or industrial fans spinning that we, you know, we kind of created an orchestra out of these field recordings. For Knives Out, the approach was completely opposite. It was like, okay, for this one, our big restriction is we're going to just use real instruments. So that was really fun to play in that sandbox, but I think even working with these classical instruments, I love kind of encouraging the players to play them in non-traditional ways. So we're still kind of playing around with that sound designy element.
So then how did you get that? I assume it's a stringed instrument, but I could be wrong.
To like grab the track of the title, okay. I'd have to go back and listen to it, but I assume I'm guessing what you're referring in Foul Play. I'm guessing that's like plucked strings, like pizzicato strings. I'm not remembering off the top of my head if there's like what specific sound designy stuff you might be referencing there. However, there's like a lot of Collegno strings in the score, which is basically just where you ask the players to turn their bows around and like whack the strings with the bow, with the wooden part of the bow. There's a lot of that textural stuff. there's, you know, there's a, I mean, I could pause and listen to it if you want me to track it down specifically, but yeah, there are a lot of different layers of things going on.
Okay. And I think that might have been it. If it was almost like a rapping sound that just sounded like you were working your way down the strings as opposed to maybe plucking them. But I got what I need from that one.
That was good.
I wanted to ask a little bit about these great music videos that you've done for Sun Lux and Lucius, specifically Sun Lux, because I noticed that one of the tracks that they've done popped up in Looper. And I, knowing like how you helped create a visual identity with them, that specific scene from Looper and maybe like anything else that you've collaborated with Ryan on going forward, how much of the visual process do you contribute to Ryan's films?
Oh, right. Totally. Yeah. Well, I mean, that is all Ryan. I in terms of when he's directing something, I'm only there on set observing and kind of, you know, marinating in that world. I think it's almost like thinking about it as two different hats. I mean, I'm so interested in that visual storytelling problem. So I feel like when I'm on Ryan's sets, I'm just observing and learning. But there is this like this natural flow. You know, I've been working with Sun Lux for years and years, and so he was the guy in Sun Lux. His name is Ryan Lott, and he's been like one of my, you know, long-term musical collaborators. He did a ton of stuff on Looper, and he was actually kind of the guy who first turned me on to this idea of using sampled sounds as playable instruments. So so he was really involved in that process. And when we were doing the nightclub scene, we were looking for music, and I actually had a Sun Lux track that I sent to my cousin, and I was like, hey, what about this? So yeah, it is a very blurry thing. Not enhanced at all by the fact that both of them are named Ryan in the way that I'm telling this story. But yeah, in terms of the music videos that I've been doing, I mean, that also is a really, it's just such a fun sandbox for me to play in. And it kind of, it's almost like the inverse of what I'm doing when I'm creating music for a movie. I feel like with music videos, I get to almost do like a visual score of the song.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm going to sidebar to home a little more into the music video of Changes Everything by Sun Lux. I encourage everybody to check that one out. But that specific video, I'm just wondering, kind of like the movie 1917, how the hell you did it.
Yeah, well, it's for those who are listening who haven't seen it, it's basically a stop motion animated video using pins and rubberized thread. And that one came about because it was kind of a small budget for the video. We didn't really have much money to work with, and I was just racking my brain trying to think of something that I could make just like in my house without a huge crew. And so what we ended up doing, my wife and I actually animated it together. I basically like created a music video with actual footage and with Ryan lip syncing. And my brother Mark, who runs the Made Shop, we worked together on like creating some vector graphics. So I basically like cut together a whole like pretend video with real imagery, and then we use this technique known as rotoscoping, but we kind of use it in an unconventional way. And rotoscoping is basically where you kind of like match by match an image by drawing on top of it. And so what we did is we just projected each frame of this temp video that I had cut together onto a poster board. And then my wife and I just spent like 2 weeks all day, every day in a room tracing and rotoscoping these images with pins and rubberized thread. This is a bad explanation. You should just go watch the video. But that, yeah, that's essentially how we did it.
Well, I'm glad to hear that you didn't, like, I don't know, trace the outline of Ryan's mouth as he's moving his lips versus, you know, doing it the image way that you did. Sounds a lot easier, but still very challenging.
Well, we did trace the outline of his mouth while he was moving his lips. That is exactly how we did it.
But like on, like specifically, like putting his head against a board and then putting, that's where I'm leaning.
We did not force him to stay in our studio for 2 weeks while we pressed very sharp pins right next to his lips. No, you're right. We did not do that.
No time. Oh, that's cool. That's cool. So speaking of the Knives Out Mondo release on vinyl, the record album, I'm curious on your thoughts on this resurgence of vinyl as opposed to digital or CD. What are your thoughts on that? And do you prefer analog to digital, or what's your take on that? Your hot take?
I think my instinct is that people like to hold on to real things. I love the digital world because of its ease, and especially with like moving around a lot, it's very nice to not like. Do you guys remember the days of like packing like 100-case CD binder
in a
Case Logic? I'd happily never go back to that time period. Like I love being able to have everything on my phone when I'm moving around. However, the downside that I've found to that is it kind of feels like the ocean, you know what I mean? Like it's just like when you have everything available, I sometimes find that I don't actually explore as much. And there is something I miss about getting a physical thing. And that just, I mean, in terms of CDs, like the idea of that just living in your car, and each time you start your car, it kind of starting from the last place it was at, rather than each time you start your car, it playing the same song at the beginning of your iTunes library. Like, but also with vinyl, like there's the amazing aspect of like, just like the artwork is a lot bigger. It's something you can really like sit with. And I think it requires a lot more, a lot more focus and planning to like sit down and listen through a record. We had a really nice experience for the vinyl release of the album. There's this amazing hi-fi record bar in the Arts District in LA, and so we got to invite some people and sit in this small room that was designed specifically for listening to records. And it's an amazing sound system. But beyond the sound system, it's just amazing to sit down with a group of people and listen to music. And I feel like we rarely do that anymore.
You know, I love doing that. I have record clubs here that I host, and everybody brings records, and I love the idea of like passing the actual album around, looking at the liner notes and the artwork, like you said, and you can't roll a joint on an MP3. you just can't do it.
One of the things that Brian here got me into records about 5-6 years ago, and that's one of the things that we kind of bonded over, is I was at his birthday party, and it was like 3 a.m. we started listening to the soundtrack to Charlie and the Chocolate Factory.
Original pressing.
Yeah, the original pressing.
And then, I'm jealous.
But the thing I like about it, and now that I've becoming a vinyl collector is it's like what you said about a special room for it. When you listen to a record, you plan for it. You know, it's something that you do in a very specific location, as opposed to whether you have a portable CD player or a Walkman, you could take it with you. But you have to plan to do that with a record, and that kind of makes it a little more impressive and memorable.
Romantic.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, I think there's something, especially as stuff gets more and more ephemeral and you know, kind of in the cloud, there's something that that I'll always love about ritual. You know, it's like making a cup of tea or making a cocktail. You know, it like requires a bit of extra work, but part of the enjoyment of it is that whole ritual of planning for it. You can't just get it out of a vending machine.
I wanted to ask about this specific Mondo release of Knives Out, just because I don't know. We had some of the guys from Mondo on our podcast before, and we got a little bit of a taste from it. Just to kind of get your end of the process, when they, whether it's the studio or they present that, hey, let's make a vinyl together, how much do you contribute to the visual look of it, and just like any of like the notes itself? Is it entirely them? Do they present you with like X number of concepts, or and you select from there, or you say, hey, this one might be a good one and kind of captures, or is it just like all them?
Yeah, they're really collaborative. I mean, I can't say enough great things about Mo and the guys from Mondo. And Jay is the designer who did the artwork for Knives Out. He also did the artwork for the Looper vinyl. Mm-hmm. And I basically for Knives Out, the first thing that he sent, I flipped out over, and I was like, I love it. Let's do this. And you know, Mo was like, yeah, so Jay's idea is that we'll have like kind of this die cut magnifying glass, and there will be all these different subjects, you know, and it'll be random, and you know, we'll have like, you know, Jay wanted to have like 10 different things, and 10 like 10 different all the family in there. And I was just like, oh, I'm so excited. I can't wait to like give each of these to each of the actors. And Mo wrote back, he's like, okay, I guess we're doing all 10. I was trying to convince Jay to like scale it down, but screw it. We're going to do all of them. Let's do it. But yeah, I mean, they're just amazing. And, you know, through the whole process, they're really gracious in terms of involving me and getting my input and feedback. But man, I love the way they work.
Sweet. And I'm curious, speaking of records, do you have like, what is the most curious or the oddest recording or album you have in your collection? Like for instance, like mine, I think one of mine would be, I have a 45 of Leonard Nimoy doing the Ballad of Bilbo Baggins from 1967.
What?
No, I didn't know it existed until I found it.
Oh, man. Wow. Ryan and I, my cousin Ryan and I, grew up, you know, making movies basically every family vacation. And we would, I wasn't like scoring them at that point. We were just like shooting them together. And then we would edit them by hooking up two VCRs and a Discman, and everyone would kind of like press pause simultaneously to try to get the edit and the music correct. And we basically didn't really have any film score CDs. Like one of the only film scores we had was John Williams' score to Hook. And,
that's
and
great.
So basically all of our childhood movies have the soundtrack from Hook scoring them.
That's not a bad soundtrack. That's
even the and, happy the happy part of it in the beginning where it's like ding, 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 ding.
Oh yeah, no, it's all over that. So anyway, so when Ryan was working with John Williams for The Last Jedi, he had him sign two things for him. He had him sign a poster for himself. And then after the session, Ryan was like, I got something for you. I was going to wait to give this to you till Christmas, but I got to give it to you right now. And he had tracked down, I think when he was in Japan, he had tracked down a Hook vinyl and had John Williams inscribe it to me. So I have that frame. I have the framed Hook vinyl from like the composer who scored our childhoods. I think that's my most prized record.
That is badass. I love that story. You just mentioned The Last Jedi. When Ryan was working on The Last Jedi, did you ever for fun send him like music files or something to like, hey, sneak this in there? Or were you allowed to do that?
There was a point he had actually had asked me to write a song for a scene that didn't end up making it into the movie, but there does exist a song that I wrote for The Last Jedi that maybe we'll use somewhere else at some point in the future.
That sounds cool.
You mean when Ryan goes into his own Star Wars trilogy?
Well, who knows?
No, maybe they'll Criterion Collection will release the Star Wars trilogy, and this song will be on it in the Criterion Collection.
I'll cross every finger I have.
It only exists in a very rough, crappy demo. But so I will never let that happen. But yeah,
that's super cool.
Well, Nathan, the shorthand that you and Ryan have is like it's telepathy at this point, I would imagine. But when he lets you in on his project or you talk to him about music, and having the relationship means you get to see things before other composers or directors might come onto a project.
Yeah.
That might make you feel too close to something. Is there a check system that helps you both maybe take a step back so you don't overthink things or, you know, just keep from getting too invested in it?
I don't know. I mean, I don't know that I'd ever shy away from getting too invested in it. But I think, I don't know, maybe the check system is, I don't know, that's a great question. And I'm kind of like bumbling around answering it. But I think it does come back to this idea of when I'm scoring something, all I'm trying to do is get inside of Ryan's head. And really the check system is, does he like it? And is this doing what he needs it to do from a narrative standpoint? And that also kind of brings up this other element, which is, you know, it's a really nice place to be in, because the way that we make movies together, there aren't other people looking over his shoulder. That there aren't seven different producers who all have their own idea of what the music should be. It's a very small team, and everything in Ryan's movies, everyone exists to serve that singular vision. I really love that. And that's not to say that every idea that I come up with makes it in. On the contrary, like Ryan is really part of him knowing what he wants means that he's really clear when something's not working, and he's never hesitant to say that. But that's not like an ego bruise to me, because I'm not like trying to make my own masterpiece. All I'm trying to do is help him tell his story.
And did his story have jazzy piano in it? Did it want it to feel like an A&E murder movie from the 80s? I mean, was there certain things that either you clued in on reading the script that maybe he didn't think of, or you convinced him that, hey, I think this is appropriate, let's run with it?
I think there's a lot of back and forth. I mean, one of the things was the car chase scene, for instance. Ryan initially was gonna play that with no music, and I I kind of had an idea for something that I thought would work doing this kind of halftime thing, but with these triplets and having all the energy kind of be up in the horns, like having it be this fun, exciting thing, but not feel like action music. I mean, I think that's the thing. Like, Ryan didn't want it to suddenly tip into an action movie, so he was going to play it dry there. And that was one instance where I was like, I have an idea of how we can do this, because I feel like it wants music. And I agree with you, like, we don't want to tip into action chase scene, but maybe we could tip into this boisterous chase scene. And so we, you know, but I don't know that he was like convinced until kind of he heard it and got it up there. And then it was like, oh yeah, this is totally working.
I like that. That's I like awesome. That.
It's like a happy medium between Drive, which I don't remember if that the chase scene had a score to it, but Fast and Furious is loaded with it.
Yes. Yes, it is. I'm curious. So one of my like favorite sounds that I wish I could listen to every day is that of an orchestra or like a big band orchestra tuning up right before going on. I just love all the swells, all of the different sounds coming from everywhere. Is there a certain sound that you gravitate towards that you just love?
Yeah, I'm spinning down a long, never-ending infinity hole. The first thing that comes to mind, I mean, I use chimey sounds a lot. I really love the celeste. Even back to Brick, the chimes that we used, that was an instrument called a metallophone that instead of playing with a mallet, we jiggled a chopstick inside of it. There's something that I just love about that, the attack, but then the clear sustain of chime based instruments, vibraphones, xylophones, all that whole family. I don't know. Now I'm stopping myself because I'm about to talk through every instrument. we'll stop there.
Well, that sounds good.
A couple years ago, there was a meme on the internet, and you saw it on Facebook and Twitter feeds. It was like six photos that chronicled every profession. So it was like, you know, medical assistant or lawyer, and it was what my parents think I do, what my friends think I do, what I really do. So is there, what's perception versus reality? What do, you know, Preston, Brian, and myself probably imagine Nathan as just being this crazy mad scientist in his laboratory, but what is the reality of being a film composer these days?
Yeah, wow, that's such a great question. Let me pause so you can cut all this silence out as I ponder this brilliant question.
Just play that song from The Last Jedi. We'll wait.
I'll tell you what, Ryan actually wrote the words to that song in another language. Like, I sent him rough words and then he translated it into a made up language. So I'm just dangling these other things for you, but you're never going to hear it.
Curses.
I think in some ways why I'm struggling is because I feel like there are so many different roles and so many different parts, and it's not sitting down at the piano all day. A big part of it, this is not what I meant to talk about, but maybe this is interesting because it's accurate, but a big part of composing for a film is all of these things that happen outside of the music element. We could talk about that for ages, but so many things from just like file management, dealing with all these things, dealing with changes, it's not like sitting down with a quill pen and just writing something out. At least from my perspective, a key part of of creating anything is like dealing with all the other things to kind of get it across the finish line. But in terms of that composing part, the way that I kind of approach it is very, very basic. Most of my ideas start as little voice audio memos on my phone. I mean, I just have like hundreds and hundreds of audio memos where I'm just kind of singing or playing the roughest idea of or the roughest version of an idea into a phone. And I think for me, that's a really key thing that marks my process is this idea of iteration. But I feel like if it's an intriguing and interesting theme or melody or whatever, it should be able to be played in its simplest form and still capture you. I remember for Knives Out, the very first, I probably spent weeks maybe writing like 40 different ideas before I stumbled onto the idea that was going to become the Knives Out theme. And when I hit that, I got this spark of excitement and I was like, I think this is something. And that was the first thing I showed to Ryan, but I played him, you know, just in crappy headphones after they finished on set one day. I just went over to the place where he was staying and played him this very rough, simple piano sketch. That was the seed that became the entire score.
That's amazing.
That is amazing. That's super cool.
Going off of that, you just made me think about, I'm curious to know what kind of composer do you think that you are in that? Are you somebody that's very meticulous when you're listening to other people's musical scores? Do you like to like break things down and kind of figure out how people achieved it? Or do you like to come up with quote unquote magic tricks of your own?
Yeah, I mean, it's maybe a bit of all of that. I honestly, when I watch movies, I'm not usually thinking about the score. I mean, I'm such a fan of the film world that the last thing I want to be doing is analyzing when I'm like sitting in a theater. I just want to be taken on a ride. But you come away and you're like, oh, I really like that score. It's actually really fun to like pull it up and break it down and kind of see what they're doing. And I kind of feel like I like to think of this artistic metaphor of like a stream, and I really like the idea of upstream and downstream, and just like embracing that. I'm downstream from so many amazing musicians and composers and artistic expressions, and it feels so rich to be in the stream where we are right now at this point in time, because we're downstream from all this amazing inspiration. And at the same time, we're, you know, try as we might to replicate things or whenever we're inspired by things, I think our own limitations as well as our own strengths kind of combine with that to become our own voice. And so I like the idea that we're, you know, potentially putting something with our own voice into the stream, and maybe that melds and kind of sifts in with other things downstream from us.
Well, who's upstream to you? Who's the top of the pyramid? Who's the person that you see yourself most wanting to be like based on the path that you're charting?
I mean, I feel really inspired. That's a great question, though. I'm struggling over it with a little bit because I think often the people that we like look up to because they have something different from what our voice is. But that's what makes this great combination. I mean, I think clearly John Williams is like just a master. but also people like Nino Rota or Morricone, even more like contemporary people like Johnny Greenwood or Mika Levy, John Bryan. I mean, these are the people who, when they make scores, I perk up. Because I love different elements about what they're doing, whether it's melodic or transgressive or experimental. And I have no idea how that comes to play on what I'm doing, but those are the people that I love. And then I guess all that mixes somehow with my abilities and inabilities.
I love all that. I think all three of us are heavy into scores, soundtracks, and I think you just listed off a lot of our favorites, you know, like Jerry Goldsmith and Cliff Martinez. Like, we, for going back, you know, far back to contemporary, I think there's a lot to like in everyone, I think. And I like that you mentioned the people that you did, because I'm a fan too.
Yeah, totally. It feels exciting that they exist, and that because of that, we get to appreciate their art.
I was going to ask about the film itself, Knives Out. You know, when it comes to a Rian Johnson movie, all three of us, like, the drool is like falling off of our lip, and we get
that's
a big...
how I feel. I promise that's how I feel every time he sends me a script. I'm like, this is so awesome.
And you know, we get our big bag of popcorn and we just like tune out the outside world, and I could list off like the effect that he's had on my personal film taste palette, but I wonder like how it has affected yours. Are you finding yourself diving into some like very obscure stories, thinking about film differently? How has his storytelling process changed the way that you take in film?
Oh, completely. I mean, we're cousins, and he's, you know, 2 or 3 years older than I am, but we were really close growing up, and in that way it feels like he was like an older brother, kind of turning me on to cool, crazy stuff that I never would have known about. I remember early on him introducing me to Fellini, and you know, knowing that there was this movie about movie making called 8 and a Half that he loved, and tracking that down. And I feel like the things that I love, a lot of those things come from him introducing them to me. He was like the older brother with great taste in that way.
No, that's great. I like that. I want to bring you into one of our fun segments now for the podcast. It's called Bloody Tunes. And it's where we each pick a song that makes us think of the film that we're talking about. So this week, of course, Knives Out and our Bloody Tune. We want to recommend this song for everybody to look at and download, in addition to, you know, buy this soundtrack from Mondo, buy this soundtrack from Knives Out. But I guess I'll start... my song, my bloody tune that I thought of when I saw Knives Out, specifically the Thrombey family theme, is actually, the song I thought of is by one of the coolest people on planet Earth, Tom Waits, and the song Murder in the Red Barn, because just hearing the Thrombey family theme, on the big screen and in the speaker, is like, oh my God, if you put Tom Waits' voice to this, I could totally see this.
Oh, geez. Now I'm never going to be able to not wish that we could do that.
Call him. I hear Tom Waits likes movies.
Yeah, I'll call him right now, since I definitely have his number right next to me right now.
And I just thought that song from Bone Machine, the album Bone Machine, Murder in the Red Barn, it has kind of like that noir quality to it, and just his cool, raspy, beaten with a bag of hammers, soaked in whiskey for 30 years voice, and I just thought that would be such a cool thing. So that's my bloody tune that I'm going to recommend.
Well, that's awesome. You're describing everything I like, and I'm glad that the Thrombey family thing made you points.
Cool. No, I'm happy.
Sure, I'll go. Mine, I got to go with Big Empty by Stone Temple Pilots. Okay. There's just something kind of lazy but purposeful about that song, and I think that's what I feel when I watch any of Ryan.
Lazy.
No, I would say easygoing, accessible. Yeah. So, but there's. Okay, let's start us over. We're gonna go in the way
all
back
the good
machine.
Adjectives.
Yeah, please don't tell Ryan I ever said that. But what I mean is that there's something. It sounds like a driving film, and what I feel like when I watch one of your cousin's movies, it's like I'm going on a long drive and enjoying the trip. And there's a line in there's a lyric that says, "Too much walking shoes worn thin," and it's about a girl. It's time to take her home. Her dizzy head is conscience laden. So I think it's all about, you know, protagonist. What is it, Marta?
Yeah,
right.
Yeah, Marta. So it's like it's all about her. And I just thought that was a good way to encapsulate the feeling of the movie. And it also says conversations kill in the song as well. So I was like, it just
there you go.
Very meta.
I like it. Preston.
I'm gonna go with this song has been used a few times in films that I've seen recently, like Black Klansman and what's that Ted Bundy movie that we saw? Extremely Wicked and
Shockingly Vile. Yeah, evil, yeah.
It was used in that. I'm a big fan of the band Midlake, and there's like they're from Denton. They have a specific kind of sound that. Pairs well with Emerson, Lake, and Palmer, and the song Lucky Man is a song that I feel like when I get a sense of thrill of accomplishment, and that's the song that I was feeling at the end of this particular film.
I like it. Nathan, do you have a specific song you would like to suggest to people that
makes you think of? Yeah, maybe not a specific song, but I would suggest the jazz piano player Jay McShann. He's if you haven't heard of him, look him up. But I feel like you know, in another world, this is maybe like the music that that is always playing inside of that house. And yeah, he's just one of my favorite piano players.
No, oh, I like that. We're definitely going to look them up. And one of our last things before you go, we do bloody recommendations where we recommend a horror film to people that may have been forgotten or something new we just want you to see. So is there any sort of genre film that you want to recommend to people that we might not have seen or that you just want to tell the world about?
That may be a little bloody.
Maybe a little bloody. Why don't you guys go first? Let me think for a second on that.
Okay. The thing that popped into my mind that I want to recommend to people at the moment, just because I haven't done it yet, I've been like rolling through all these TV shows that I've been meaning to catch up on, like Watchmen, Righteous Gemstones, and the one that I watched that just came out last month at the end of last year. Was The Witcher, and there's a particular episode that has a great horror vibe to it with one specific creature design that looks like it was plucked out of a Guillermo del Toro film. But in addition, it has probably the most catchy tune that, I mean, it's like taking over the internet at this point with the Toss a Coin to Your Witcher, O Valley of Plenty. And if you haven't seen The Witcher, you might hear somebody saying that, but I suggest that you watch the show so you can have that and you can whistle along and sing that as well.
That's cool. My quick one this week, it's a documentary. It's the Aaron Hernandez documentary that's coming out on Netflix this Friday. And it's bloody, and it's a fantastic look into the life and mind of this former football player. But I have to, if we're talking about score, the score to the opening of each episode of this miniseries mixes a haunting and eerie sound with like Monday Night Football type of score. And it's just so interesting. I never thought I would hear something like that, but it's actually an excellent kind of horrific documentary, and I recommend it. Mark?
I'm going to go with Turbo Kid.
Oh, heck yes, Turbo Kid.
It's a fun 80s throwback that has buckets, gobs, dump trucks of blood for, you know, impossible fluid dynamics are in this movie, but it's so cheesy and fun. It's enjoyable.
There you go. And Nathan?
I was just thinking I'm sure you guys have seen this, but it didn't get a lot of love. I really loved this movie called The Guest.
The Guest. We talked with the filmmakers and actor, and I think we all own the soundtrack on vinyl to The Guest. So.
Oh, so good. So good. Yeah. Well, I'll stick with that one then.
We just become best friends?
Yeah. Yep. So much room for
activity. We're all spirit animals now. This is great.
This is great. Nathan, thank you so much for joining My Bloody Podcast. We really appreciate it, and we hope to have you on at some point in the future. If you ever want to come on, you have the door is wide open.
Well, thanks so much for having me. So good to talk to you guys.
Yes, yes, everybody, buy Knives Out, the soundtrack, you know, put that on your Oscar ballot as well. Yeah. And buy the movie when it comes out. It's great, and listen to this score. It is fantastic. Thank you, Nathan Johnson.
Thanks, you guys.
All right, have a good one.